The final case for argument this morning is Wildwood Association versus the City of Rapid City and Harley F. Taylor, and there are several other parties involved. For the appellants, Harley Taylor and Red Rock Development Company, Mr. Terry Westergaard, an attorney from Rapid City, is that correct?
Yes.
All right, and you'll be arguing 7 minutes. All right, and then for the appellants, Leo Hamm family, would be Mr. Jerry Johnson.
Correct.
And Mr. Johnson, you'll be doing the 7 minute and then 3 minute on rebuttal also. All right, and then finally would be Mr. Michael Boer, an assistant city attorney for the City of Rapid City, also 7 minutes and 3 minutes, is that correct?
That's correct.
All right, and Mr. Carpenter represents the appellees and will be using a full 20 minutes, correct, sir? Okay. Now, I don't know on my sheet here which of you are going to use the 7 minutes in which order, so I'll just leave that to you folks, and you may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel? My name is Michael Boer, assistant city attorney for the City of Rapid City. The issue in this case, and this appeal considers in particular, as a matter of law, what affirmative acts of a municipality are sufficient to show that municipality's intent to vacate a section line? What official government act must exist to vacate a section line? Now, a brief recitation of the case and its material facts is necessary at this point to lay some context. On August 6th of 2001, Plaintiff Wildwood Association filed its complaint against the defendant, City of Rapid City, Leo Hamm Family Ranch, Harley Taylor, requesting a declaratory judgment and estoppel and injunctive relief. That complaint was amended on December 5th of 2001 and again on May 29th of 2002 to add more defendants and some minor changes. And on the court trial on June 4th through 6th of 2002, the Honorable Circuit Court, Judge James Anderson, ruled in favor of Plaintiff Wildwood Association in finding that, in fact, the section line has been vacated. Now, Wildwood Subdivision is a residentially developed area that is adjacent to and west of Sheridan Lake Drive in Rapid City, South Dakota. Wildwood was essentially created in two phases. The first is by a subdivision plat in 1978, and the second phase by another subdivision plat in 1979. Wildwood is bordered on the south by a section line. And, of course, that section line is the subject of this dispute. Five lots within Wildwood itself lie immediately north of that section line. And those five residents are named plaintiffs to this lawsuit and appeal. On January 16th of 1978, the first portion of Wildwood subdivision was created by a plat expressly showing the 66-foot easement. That's a 1978 plat. The subsequent plat in 1979, developing lots 18 through 21, were platted and approved. The section line is apparent, but the section line right-of-way does not exist on, I believe, the south portion of that section line.
And at that time, it was not in the city limits of Rapid City, correct?
Exactly, Your Honor. And that leads me to two very important factual considerations before I get into the argument. First is that the 1979 plat, the subsequent plat, did not expressly vacate the previous plat, the 78 plat. And second is, very importantly, that Wildwood subdivision was not a part of the Rapid City limits in 1978-79. It was annexed in 1984, 5 years later. It was not a part of the City of Rapid City in 1978-79 when that approval of those plats took place. Now, when it was annexed in 1984, it was done through the statutory requirements and by an annexation map. That's requirement in 9411. That map shows the area to be annexed, which is what statute requires. It also shows some streets to give some context to that area.
That map is different than a plat in legal terms.
Absolutely. And that is, of course, the centerpiece for our argument on, in response to the circuit court's finding that that annexation map somehow vacated the section line. We find that finding in error because if you notice on the annexation map, it doesn't name any easements. It doesn't set any public grounds.
Did you bring this, specifically bring this to the attention of the trial court?
We did, Your Honor. I believe it's the transcript to confirm that. That was the central component of the argument at the summary judgment level and again, waived by the defendants, Ms. Ackerman.
It wasn't just a subtle point or something? I mean, you clearly...
This was, excuse me, I'm sorry. That was a cornerstone of the argument on summary judgment, and it was certainly brought again to bear at the trial court, that a map is not a plat, and that if you have a subdivision plat, obviously you have a number of different requirements, including the recitation of section lines and easements and so on. In this case...
What was his answer to that?
And part of that I can leave to Mr. Carpenter's argument, but I believe, and he can correct me if I'm wrong, that in this case, we showed some streets on the plat and the map, and that by showing the streets, we showed that we were trying to comply, and that in essence, I think he'll argue that there is a distinction between annexation map and a plat. I believe that's the argument from his brief, but I'll let him address that if it's different.
But Judge Anderson didn't make any specific response to your cornerstone argument?
He did, Your Honor, and his finding that it was a vacation of the section line in this case is based on basically four purported affirmative acts, the first of which is the approval of the subdivision plats. The second is the annexation map. The third and fourth are the granting of building permits and the maintenance of setback requirements. It is those four affirmative acts that the circuit court found sufficient to vacate a section line. Our argument as a matter of law is that none of them are sufficient to show you indicia of intent of the municipality's intent to vacate. And that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about were there enough official government acts on the record to show the court this intent to vacate a section line. And that is, of course, the basis for our appeal.
Is there any significance to the fact that the 1979 plat did not identify the easement? It just showed the section line.
With regard to the question whether there's significance, I would say that it is insufficient to show vacation of a section line. It is not significant enough to show that there was an intent to vacate that section. As I said, it didn't expressly vacate the previous 78 plat, and more importantly, it was not at a time when that land was not part of the city limits. Now, clear case law from this court establishes that you cannot vacate section lines. The city can't vacate section lines outside of its own city limits.
Okay, but the county could have.
The county could vacate the section line, but that's, of course, not an issue for this appeal. The issue is whether or not the city...
Could they have vacated it on the 79 plat? Because both the city and the county, didn't they both vote and approve that?
They did, and I think Millard is instructive in this case, Your Honor. Millard suggests that mere approval of a plat in and of itself is insufficient to vacate a section line. I think you have a similarity of facts in that case, where you do have denotation of a section line, but not of that 33-foot easement. And this court found that as a matter of law, there is no vacation of that section line. I think the Millard case speaks to that issue and suggests that it isn't significant to vacate a section line. Insufficient. I'd like to talk, if I may, a bit about... Excuse me. Guess I won't. Thank you.
We'll leave that to either Mr. Westergaard or Mr. Johnson.
May it please the court, counsel. Picking up where Mr. Brewer left off, the trial court entered findings of fact and then a conclusion of law, which indicated that the Rapid City Common Council vacated this section line right-of-way three ways. Number one, by approving the 1978 subdivision plat, approving the 1979 subdivision plat, and then approving the annexation of Wildwood in 1984. Let's turn to the two plats. Phase one of the subdivision is covered by the 1978 plat. That plat shows the north 33 feet of that section line right-of-way across the bottom of lots 18 through 23, and those lots are owned by the individual plaintiffs in this case. Phase two is covered by the 1979 plat. It's true that that plat does not show that north 33 feet. If you look at Chapter 11-3, the statute indicates that a subsequent plat does not vacate or supersede a prior plat unless it's expressly stated on the subsequent plat. That 79 plat in no way tempers that 78 plat. So if this court were to go to the Register of Deeds office, they would find a 1978 plat showing across the bottom of lots 18 through 23 that north 33 feet of a section line right-of-way. And that's why I submit that when the individual plaintiffs got their title documents in the 1990s, the section line right away disclosed their title documents. And that's why three of those plaintiffs got surveys, which they signed off on in the 90s. And if you look at those surveys, they're attached to my appendix, you'll see superimposed across those lots the north 33 feet of that section line right away. So, as a matter of fact, the section line right away is on those plats. As a matter of law, without regard to what those plats show, this court has clearly held in Millard versus City of Sioux Falls that a municipality cannot vacate a section line in approving subdivision plats within its 3-mile plotting jurisdiction. In 1978 and 1979, when those plats were prepared, Wilder was not part of the city. So no matter what the city did in approving those plats, that cannot, as a matter of law, constitute a vacation of that section line right away. Now, let's quickly go to the 1984 annexation. The plaintiff and the trial court below maintained that in annexing Wildwood, the common council approved, this is very important, approved an annexation plat like the plat this court was faced with in City of Sioux Falls versus Holm. In that case, at the time of annexation, the city commission approved a plat that did not show the section line right away, and this court held that it was vacated. This is very, very important. Here, the trial court, the plaintiff characterized this document as an annexation plat. It is not an annexation plat. If you look at this court's decision in Holm, the court was very, very carefully indicated that the plat that it was addressing had been submitted and prepared under the terms of STCL Chapter 11-3 and, in fact, had been approved by the City Commission. If you look at Chapter 11-3, there's also a statute that indicates unless and until City Council puts a certificate on that document saying it's a plat and they've approved it, you can't even file it with the Register of Deeds. If you look in the 78 and 79 plats...
So what you're saying is that a plat has certain legal requirements signed off by various public officials and boards. A map is a map in the eye of the beholder.
Saying is, until you follow the rules, a map is not a plat.
Okay.
What we have here is the City Council passing a resolution indicating that they're going to annex Wildwood. When that's done, the mayor, pursuant to STCL 9-4-11, went out and had an annexation map prepared. And you look at that statute, all that requires is that you generally describe the territory that's being annexed. You look at that document, there is no certificate on there by the City Council indicating that that map had been produced pursuant to the requirements of Chapter 11-3, and it wasn't approved by the council. It's not an annexation plat. So therefore, Hone is completely inopposite to this case. So the 78 plat, 79 plat, and this map, as a matter of law, did not result in a vacation of that section line right away. There's also an indication that issuing of building permits, statements made during staff reports, during comprehensive planning, constitute a vacation of the section line. SDCL 31-18-1 says only authorized public officials, boards, and tribunals can vacate a section line. If you look at, once again, 11-3, that chapter, all the way through there, who has the power over these plats? The governing body of the municipality, either the City Commission or the Common Council. So only the Common Council of the city can vacate a section line. Now, I don't mean to be cute, but it can't be the janitor. It can't be a building permit official. It can't be an engineer. Only the Common Council can vacate. Now I want to turn quickly to whether or not the access across Lot 23 is a impliedly dedicated public right-of-way. We're not claiming that the 1978 plat, which first shows this access, constitute an express dedication. We are claiming, however, that it constitutes an implied public dedication. This court indicated in Atlas Lumber Company that if you have a space on a plat and it's not expressly dedicated as a public right-of-way. However, it is an extension of a clearly dedicated public right-of-way. Then, it is an impliedly dedicated right-of-way. Here we have a 66-foot wide access which connects a public street to the north, which is 66-foot wide, Wildwood Drive, with a 66-foot wide section line right-of-way to the south. That connection can be nothing other than an impliedly dedicated public right-of-way. If the court believes that it is not an impliedly dedicated public right-of-way, then we claim that it is an impertinent easement.
And we'll let Mr. Westergaard take it from there.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. For Harley Taylor and for Red Rock, this is a case about restrictions. It's about Wildwood Association attempting to restrict the future development of the property to the south and the west of Wildwood Association. It's also about restricted access for these two individuals and these two corporations. I agree with everything that's been said by Mr. Johnson and Mr. Boer regarding the section line. There's one unique issue that applies to Harley Taylor and to Red Rock concerning the section line. One of the conclusions of the law was that the entire section line along lots 18 through 23 was vacated. That was one of the conclusions of law found by Judge Anderson. There was no evidence presented during the trial that there was anything done to concern the north 33-foot section line right-of-way established in the statute. None of the exhibits that were offered by the plaintiff concerns the north 33 feet. The 78 plat had the south 33 feet of the section line shown on the plat. None of the plats, none of the annexation maps concerned any property to the north. So we're asking on behalf of Harley Taylor and Red Rock that even if this court in the alternative finds that the section line was somehow vacated, that you find that there was nothing done concerning the north 33 feet of this section line. That provides access for Red Rock and for Harley Taylor. As far as Red Rock goes, it's not Red Rock development, as the association has attempted to say. Red Rock owns a small piece of property that's adjacent to Wildwood and adjacent to Harley Taylor. It's about 3 acres. That's the access that we're talking about in this case.
Why do we need to deal with this 33 feet as an alternative basis that you just suggested? If the trial court didn't rule on it, it's not the subject of the judgments that have been filed, is it?
The trial court ruled on it to the extent that there is a conclusion of law indicating that the entire section line right-of-way has been vacated. And I read that as the entire 66 feet provided by 3118.2. And we're asking that only in the alternative. We agree that the section line should now, no part of the section line should be vacated. But if any part is found to have been vacated, we're asking that only the south, not the north.
I think your evidence shows that the plat map only runs through half the section line. That there's an exhibit in one of the appendices here that shows the plat map, and I think specifically shows running down the middle of the section line.
Correct, Justice Sirsa. As far as section line and the easement issues, they've been addressed by Mr. Johnson and Mr. Ward. I'll take up as far as the pertinent easement argument. In this case, we have a 66-foot access easement that connects two public right-of-ways. It connects Unidale Drive and Wildwood Drive to the statutorily established section line highway. This is not an access easement that connects a private lot to a road or connects a private lot to another private lot. This connects public highways to a public highway. It's not just a mere personal privilege like an easement in gross. I think of an example of an easement in gross as a billboard easement. We drive around down the interstate and see billboards all over. Those are easements for that specific purpose. That billboard easement does not allow you and I to travel on that property. It only allows the sign company to place the billboard on the property. That's a good example of an easement in gross. In this case, what we have is far beyond a personal easement in gross for the benefit of Lot 23. It's, like I said, a 66-foot public easement that connects public driveways. You look at the intent as to what the parties that created this easement intended, and the intent is shown by the purchase agreement, and this intent is that there'll be access to the property to the west and the south of Wildwood Association, or Wildwood Association.
Oh, wait a minute. You say that there's, I don't recall seeing that language in the purchase agreement. I remember seeing something simply saying that the seller, there was something between the buyer and the seller retaining or giving, but are you saying that was, it was specifically?
It was not specifically, Your Honor.
Okay.
But the implied intention is that there should be access to the section line across Lot 23, so the property owners can have access to the property to the west and south of Wildwood after this area is developed.
So are you saying the access easement doesn't go directly south from, as you extend the line from Unadel, but it angles over to the southwest, I believe, to the section line? Is that what you're showing there that's marked in yellow on this map?
Yes. Yes, Justice Sabers. That impliedly, from that language, from the location of the access easement going to the section line, shows that the party's intent was that the property to the west and south should have access by this access easement.
Is this access easement identical in limits or its extent to the property attempted to be condemned by the city?
As I understand it, Your Honor, it's not identical. It is a similar area, as was explained by the city attorney. The condemnation involves this access easement. I think it involves a little additional property also beyond what this access easement pertains to.
The condemnation would go further over onto Lot 23. It'd go further over southwest.
As I understand it, that's correct.
Okay.
As I indicated, this easement is much more than just a mere personal privilege. This is a public access. The public has used this. This road is an improved gravel road. I'm not sure of the exact width of the road, but it can be traveled easily by vehicular traffic. It's an extension of the other roads from Wildwood to the section line.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Carpenter, sir, you have 20 minutes. Actually, in fairness, you probably should have 21.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm going to try to move right along because there's a lot of issues in this particular appeal. And I want to make just a side comment. First of all, there's been some discussion and exhibits produced about title insurance. Obviously, what a title insurance company insures or excludes from its commitments has no bearing on whether the section line is vacated or not vacated, or what the private insurance company did as far as listing it has no probative value. As set forth in the City of Sioux Falls versus Hone, the question of whether a section line was vacated is a factual one governed by the clearly erroneous standard. The clearly erroneous standard extends to findings based on documentary as well as oral evidence pursuant to STCL 156-52A as amended. Now, in the arguments that have been presented, there's been a lot of discussion about the two plats, and the claim is that under Lowe versus the City of Sioux Falls, that when the property was outside of the city limits, that the city could not vacate the section line, And of course, Lowe was in 1910, and it's before there was any extraterritorial territorial jurisdiction at all. And I'd like to, the thing that wasn't mentioned is if you go to those plats, you'll see that the corners of the lots extend to the section line. When the geographical area of the lots is calculated as required by statute and listed on the plat, it includes the area of the 33-foot alleged section line easement. And the it's of critical importance because you'll see as we go forward through the scenario of these homes and these lots that when the various building permits were approved, including the permit on the Oswald House by the property or by the county, that those building permits were based on the 25-foot City of Rapid City setback requirement, which would apply also to the three-mile jurisdiction. They permitted the house of the Finns to be built within 3 feet of this alleged public road. It permitted the Oswald's drainage field to be built in this alleged public right-of-way. And it also permitted the Oswald's home to be built within 12 feet of the alleged public right-of-way. Now, we presented at trial three plats that our testimony showed were selected at random based on some suggested areas from our expert that we go and look and get that. And they showed how when you get into a municipality, into the three-mile jurisdiction, how a plat reflects that the section line is a part of the public right-of-way, and it does so by the corner pins extend only to that 33-foot right-of-way, and of course the setback requirement starts from that point. Now the city said, yeah, that's not the case, that's not the way it's done. I don't remember if the other defendants said the same thing, but no one presented a plat that showed any different type of platting for designating a section line right-of-way within the three-mile jurisdiction or within a municipality. And in fact, when the city put in a plat because of the requirement to show how the 10-foot extra shield is required if there are double-sided lots, the city put in a plat, and that plat was the same as the ones that we put in. And I hope I'm making myself clear, but if this is the section line and these are my client's lots, the corners of the lots and the geographical scope of those lots is on that approved plat include that 33 feet. All of the plats that we showed where the section line road was to be, section line was to be as a public right-of-way, all stopped at that 33 feet for obvious reasons.
Didn't the property owners at some point in time at least initiate, some of them, a petition to vacate the section line? What year was that?
That involved property owners further down. I don't remember the year it would be shown. I think it's one of the exhibits in the back of Mr. Johnson's brief. I think in the 80s sometime.
So that's not the same area that you're talking about?
It comes, I think, up to the line of the access easement in lot 23. But they were talking about going on to, I believe, the south.
But at least at some point in time, whenever that was, the property owners that signed that assumed that there was a section line.
But those property owners aren't, I guess maybe a small space of that, but those property owners aren't the property owners that have the lots that were.
Didn't affect that 79 plat on those lots, is that?
No, it did not affect the 79 plat. It would have affected a small part of the 1978 plat. Now, that was never submitted. It was never fully signed. And it was part of a settlement that was being discussed. The record doesn't show what the issues were, but between the developers and some adjacent property owners.
You said they were further south, but as I look at the map, with this being north, and this is a section line we're talking about, they either had to be east or west of it, right?
They would be to...
To the west?
To the west, yes.
All right.
Or Sheridan Lake Road.
You know, Mr. Carpenter, notwithstanding what you know what we do here, Mr. Westergaard, right, though? The judge could only vacate half of the right-of-way, and his or your clients, by platting, would only vacate half the right-of-way, and his half the right-of-way is still available to his clients?
Well, I recognize that as a question, and...
I think it's a good question.
I think it is a good question. I think that it's within the three-mile jurisdiction. And I guess the only thing that I would point the court to is that there seems to be some kind of an assumption that there are section line roads within municipalities. And of course, that isn't so. 11-3-6, and I want to be sure to get to the other issues, says this is the platting approval jurisdiction. It says, if it appears that the system of streets set forth therein, they're talking about a plat in the three-mile jurisdiction or within the municipality, conforms to the system of streets of existing plats in the municipality, then it shall be approved. Just stop and think about it a minute. There is no absolute section line highway in any city. The cities, by statute, cities of the size of Rapp City are required to adopt a comprehensive plan, a major street plan, and that is set to what the requirements of the cities are for their streets and not to some section line highway. You can't go into the city and say, I'm going to build a street on this section line, and I don't think that anyone here is going to claim that that's the case. As far as then we get on to the question, and I think it all adds together, we get on to the question of the annexation. Now, the defendants don't mention. They mention they want to quarrel with, and of course, I don't know of anything in the Supreme Court's opinion in Hone or Millard that says that they had an annexation plat other than the same as is in the case of this annexation. That's a claim that's made by the parties. It's not a claim that's supported by the cases. And they never mention the resolution of annexation that was part of it. And what are some of the things that the resolution of annexation included? It listed all of the streets. It said how many streets there were. It said how long the streets were. It said how they were going to mow the streets. It said how they were going to pave the streets. It said how they were going to take the snow off the streets, how many street signs they would have to have, and how many traffic signs they would have to have. And this map or plat, whatever you want to call it, does meet the statutory requirements. The statutory requirements say that the lots be shown to scale, that the streets be shown to scale, and it does show. It shows all of the lots, it shows all of the streets, and it is to scale, and it does not show, as in the case of Home or Millard, it does not show the section line. I believe one of those even showed the section line. This shows no section line at all. Then we go subsequent, of course, and we have the building permits that are approved. And I think a perfect example of why the court should find the vacation. Here it was pointed out, and then there was a stipulation to supplement the record, that on the Osbornes, the approval of the initial building permit was by the county. And it's a perfect example. If you look at it, it's submitted to the county, and it says, this is for the drain field that got built partially in that 33 feet. It says, distance from property lines, 30 feet. 30 feet. That property line is the lines I've been telling you. That's the line that's right on that section line. It says distance from the public right-of-way, it's 160 feet. That's Wildwood Drive that's sitting on the front of that lot.
So does the city, under your theory, would, just by providing this map on an annexation map with the streets on it and no indication of a highway, in and of itself, that act vacates the section line easement? Is that your, what you're saying?
That's our position, Your Honor.
And there need not be any other notice or, I mean, normally when you vacate, you have to give, you know, the property owners and have to be involved in it, and so where does that come in, and how do you get to that point without following any of those other procedures?
Well, I think we go back to 1136 and the system of streets within a municipality, and that has to be established by the city planning. And as far as the notice requirement is concerned, you may be referring to the Mika Street. That notice requirement talks about established city streets. There has never been an established city street at this location at any time to vacate. So, and I think it's the same thing that happened in Millard when the annexation happened. There's no discussion of any notice of vacation or anything else. It was held that by that plat, it was annexed. And the 11-3-1.1.5 defines a plat as a map or representation on paper of a piece of land subdivided into lots. That's what our exhibit shows. Parcels, tracts, or blocks. It shows that, including streets, commons, and public grounds, if any, all drawn to scale. This has every one of those requirements.
So it would automatically vacate it unless it indicated otherwise, which it did in the Millard.
On the annexation, right. That's what happened, and that's what happened in Millard.
In Millard. And
Millard doesn't say that, as I read it, Millard doesn't say, and I've got it quoted in the brief, or in my argument at least, and I want to move to the other one, but Millard doesn't say that you can't vacate by approving the plats. That isn't the way I read it. What Millard says is that absent annexation, there has to be a specific showing or specific act or specific finding. I think that's almost a verbatim quote from Millard. And I think that's here, and it's here in space because we have it every step of the way. The geographical area that's required to be laid out includes, for those lots, includes the plats that we show that show how it's done, show that it doesn't include it when it's done, when that section line right of way is to be maintained. Now I want to go to the 66-foot access easement, and I think maybe one comment can help the court more than any other, and I think Justice Sabers was getting on that point, but it's like it's moot, because the city, through its testimony in this case, established that a road to meet city standards cannot be built on this alleged access easement. Now they use this cliche or this buzzword of we're connecting public grounds. If you were going to connect public trying to connect public right-of-ways, if that was your intent or your purpose, and if you look at the exhibits, and we have bigger exhibits, but if you look at the 1978 plat and on lot 23, you see that the two lines that are labeled access easement, you'll see that they're offset. They don't hook onto Unadel Drive. If you wanted to hook Unadel Drive onto some other location, you would line it up with Unadel Drive and you would go across. And there's been some mention, and I know I'm going fast, but there's been some mention about the reservation that Justice Zinter asked about in that contract for deed. That reservation doesn't say a 66-foot access easement to the section line. It says a 66-foot access to the south side of the section line. If you were trying to hook those up, you wouldn't get an access easement going to the, and I hope I have my directions right now, but to the south side, you would run an access easement right up to the section line, the other 33 feet, the north 33 feet. But as I say, I mean, there's nothing on that. It says the words access easement. There's nothing that describes who any alleged dominant tenement is. The court heard the testimony under the Salway case, I believe it is, that we submitted as a late authority. This court pointed out in that case that parole evidence could be considered by the court to determine the scope or the type of the easement. There was evidence, all kinds of that evidence in this case, with no objection. The finding of the court was that this was, and as you look at it, a driveway, essentially, in gross private easement. That's the way it's been used since 1978 forward. It's had the private drive sign. When you look at the plats, and all these are in our brief, but you look at the plats, all of the dedicated areas are required by statute, as the court well knows. The public areas are required to be set up. Public areas are not included. This access easement is not included. When you lay out a street, it has to have certain coordinates, and it has to have curb data. That is not included. You have a chart that calculates all the area for that, that's supposed that if to include the publicly dedicated route. That is not included.
What about Mr. Westergaard's argument that he would have access to the north half?
To the north half. Well, that depends on, I guess, Your Honor, whether, and I guess it's a question I haven't found any authority on at all. And I guess the question would be whether the court in the 3-mile jurisdiction, whether the municipality in the annexation, the approval of the plats on a part of the section line, whether that affects the north half. I guess that would be the question. I don't know of any.
I can't see how the north half would have been in front of the court, because the only way the court had jurisdiction in this case is because of the plat and Wildwood Association, and Wildwood Association has no claim on that north half.
Right. No. I recognize fully what you're saying, and I guess it would have to be only in the. And I don't know the finding actually says the section line adjacent to those lots. And to extend it to the north half, you would have to treat it, I guess, as a unity.
As far as this easement, who actually used it? The original purchase agreement, there were two parties involved. Was there someone then subsequent to that, other than those the owners of those properties and their subsequent owners, that ever used that easement?
Yeah, the easement was used basically by Leo Ham to go to his pasture, and as a driveway to go to the Taylor property. And I think that's replete all, we've got it cited in the brief. And there's all kinds of instances. Why in the world would Leo Ham ask the city to acquire this easement if in fact it was, and make it public if it was already a public easement? He said at a public meeting it was a private easement. The city attorney said at a public meeting it was a private easement. Leo Ham gave Bill Grody's wife permission to drive down this easement if she wanted to. And on this Elkins memo, you know, the deal with Ham, where it said that he was going to get this, and then someday later he would dedicate it to the public so that he could control the access. My time is up. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Carpenter. Mr. Carpenter, I believe you left a binder.
Oh, thank you.
Gentlemen, you have 3 minutes apiece.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. The first issue I want to address is the notion by the plaintiffs that granting of building permits and the maintenance of setback requirements can somehow serve as an affirmative official government act to vacate a section line. The testimony here in the record from Kurt Bechtel, who is a plant examiner for the city of Rapid City, is very illustrative. And essentially, that testimony of Kurt Bechtel shows how plans are both reviewed and approved by the city of Rapid City. He issues permits, construction permits, based on sketches and plans submitted by the applicant. That's how the process works, and that's what his testimony is.
But, you know, isn't the city bound by their agents, whether they're in the Planning Commission or the Zoning Commission or whatever? And if they give somebody a building permit to build right on a section line, isn't that going to be binding on the city?
And I would argue that it isn't, because what you're trying to determine is whether or not there's sufficient intent of that city to vacate the section line. If a plans examiner, an employee of the city, is looking at a permit and a sketch provided by an applicant, and everything else seems in order, there's no intent by approving that to vacate the section line. Quite the contrary. And that's why I think that courts, without fail, in South Dakota, have not vacated a section line by the acts of an employee. Because you're looking and your focus is there sufficient intent to vacate that section line? And really, to determine that bold move, whether you want to intend to vacate a section line, the acts of an employee who's looking at a sketch that doesn't show a section line and makes the checks it off as an approval, doesn't show that sufficient affirmative action to vacate that section line. It's a matter of showing intent to vacate.
Does the man still have the right to have the house where the building permit permitted?
Well, again, in this case in particular, that individual had noticed that the section line existed at that particular location. Mr. Carpenter points out
that... You're saying only the landowner gets burned and the city official walks.
Well, in this case in particular, and of course that's my focus, you've got a landowner who has notice of that section line. There's explicit notice of the section line. As Mr. Carpenter points out, that may not be binding on whether or not the city affirmatively acted. It does show that when they came to city with their plans and sketches for the building approval, they had knowledge that that section line existed. So them getting burned...
When the bulldozer comes along and knocks down his house, he just out.
I'm sorry?
I see when the bulldozer comes down right away and just knocks down his house, he just stuck.
Well, in this case, obviously, the bulldozer is not going to come knock on his house. But as a matter of law, the acts of an employee plans examiner cannot vacate a section line. And I think that's the point. We're looking for indicia of intent to vacate. And in this case, Kurt Bechtel, or whoever the plans examiner may have been, approving a building permit is not a sufficient act to vacate that section line as a matter of law. And I think that's the point here. Now, this process of granting building permits and maintaining setback requirements are beyond the scope of that plans examiner's review.
Thank you, counsel.
Pardon me?
Thank you. Your time has expired.
Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Your Honor. As Mr. Carpenter pointed out, the 1978 and 1979 subdivision plats do show the corners of those lots going down to the section line proper itself. Once again, the 78 plat also shows superimposed across there, across lots 18 through 23, the north 33 feet of that section line right away. And it's also not surprising that those lots go down to section line proper. As I said in my brief, under Wells versus Pennington County, this court held long ago that when Congress enacted these section line right-of-way statutes and South Dakota adopted them, the property owner owns a property right up to the section line, but he takes subject to the right-of-way. So prior to improvement, to actually blacktopping the section line right-of-way, there's nothing wrong with having the plat showing the lots going right down to the section line proper. The plaintiff's exhibits would show the section line or the lot line stopping at the right-of-way themselves are in cases where the actual public right-of-way has been blacktopped. At that point, it makes sense to stop the lots at the right-of-way. But until they're blacktopped and improved, there's nothing inconsistent with having those lots going down the section line because the property owner owns them subject to the right-of-way. As far as Finn's house and Oswald's home, as they're being close proximity to that section line right-of-way, the undisputed testimony from the city was, back when those homes were built, I should say Oswald's deck and Finn's home, back when that construction work was done, the city allowed, if there was a section line right-of-way, had a 33-foot de facto setback. Now it's different. Now it's 58 feet. You have to have 33 feet for the half of the section line right-of-way and an additional 25 feet. That was not the setback when Oswald's deck was built or when Finn's home was constructed. As far as the drain field for Oswald's, the evidence is clear in the record that the county issued the permit for Oswald's home in the drain field prior to annexation by the city. The city didn't do that, so that cannot be laid at the doorstep of the city.
What about Mr. Carpenter's argument that in the extraterritorial jurisdiction area, there are no section lines when a plat is filed?
I guess I don't follow the...
Well, as I understood, he relied on 1136 to suggest that in that extraterritorial limit, a city could by accepting plats essentially vacate?
All it says in 11-3-6, which also was discussed either in Holman or Lard, is that in looking at these plats, your job as a city is to make sure that the streets are consistent with the other streets within the city, that they're consistent. There was no highway on this section line at the time. This was 1978, 1970, nothing inconsistent.
Your time has expired, Council. Thank you. Westergaard, you have 3 minutes, sir.
Please, the court. Back to the issue of the map versus the plat discussion. In this case, the annexation map is attached as the third exhibit in the Harley Taylor brief. That map shows substantial other property other than just the Wildwood Association area. That map lacks the detail of a plat. It doesn't show 7 major drainage easements just in the Wildwood area. It doesn't show the well easement on lot 23. If you take Mr. Carpenter's argument as true, then the major drainage easements and the well easement should also be vacated. The map does not have the specificity of the plats. It does not show the measurements of the road. It doesn't show the drainage easements. It doesn't show a lot of information the plat has on it.
It just simply shows the exterior boundaries to be annexed.
Exactly. It shows the whole area. It doesn't go into the detail that plat goes into. In this case, the appellants are trying to maintain the integrity of the section line right-of-way and the access easement. Mr. Carpenter's talked about the possibility that the road could not even be built on this access easement. We're all talking speculation at that point. If this property to the west and south is ever to be developed, plans will have to be submitted to the city by the developer. That's not the stage we're at. We're merely at the stage of trying to maintain the integrity so that if someone wants to develop this area in the future, they still have the opportunity. As we all know, plans and specifications can make a big difference in what the road's going to look like. Things can be done in the planning stage and the development stage to make these roads fit in that area. And if they don't, they won't be approved. But we're not at that stage. We just want to maintain the integrity at this point. This is not a driveway, as suggested by Mr. Carpenter. It's a gravel road that heads off of Unadel Drive and Wildwood Drive. It heads up to the west and the south. It's been traveled by all the property owners to the west and the south.
Is there an exhibit, a photograph of it in the record?
Yes, there are, Your Honor. There are several photographs of this.
As it comes across or would come into contact where the section line right-of-way was?
Yes, there are photographs.
Thank you.
And I want to know about the attachment to the two other public right-of-way areas. Mr. Carpenter suggested the original agreement did not show literal attachment at both ends.
The access easement attaching to the section line?
Right.
The easement itself does, if you look at exhibit number 1, the access easement does attach to the section line proper. It does not attach to the north end of the section line right away. It goes all the way to the middle of the section line. And that's shown on exhibit 1 of the brief in Harley Taylor and Red Rock.
It attaches at the south, but not the north.
It attaches at the middle, as I would say.
Okay.
Thank you, Council. Your time has expired. We will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.